Hello and welcome to the Fluid Mechanics 101 podcast. This podcast is going to be slightly different to the usual series of talks and lectures that you're used to seeing from me on YouTube. What I'm going to be doing in this podcast is interviewing and talking with a variety of different guests. Now, these guests are going to be engineers and scientists, both from the academic and industrial sides of engineering, usually with a focus on fluid mechanics, computational fluid dynamics, and the normal topics that we talk about here on Fluid Mechanics 101. And what I'm going to be doing is discussing with these guests their experiences and what they've been through as engineers, researchers, academics, and industrial practitioners. I'm also going to be talking about specific things that they're looking at the moment, where their interests are, some of the challenges they've been through, and what they're currently looking at. So for you as the listener, it's going to give a fantastic opportunity for you to gain some insight into what real engineers do in their day-to-day practice and some interesting insights and learning from different fields of engineering that you may not be used to yourself or you may not have any experience with yourself. So this is going to be slightly different content to my usual lecture series that you're used to seeing, but I'm sure you're going to get a lot of interesting value from listening to the talks. In the first talk today, in episode one, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Chris Vogel. Chris has been a colleague of mine for the past few years, and he's currently a lecturer and researcher at the University of Oxford. And Chris was lecturing at the University of Oxford while I was doing my doctoral research, and Chris currently focuses on tidal turbine and wind turbine energy extraction. So Chris has some very interesting thoughts and insights from the renewable energy sector and the renewable energy field, including some which are related to CFD and computational fluid dynamics. So I know if you're interested in the renewable energy sector and how things are progressing with wind tidal turbines, you're going to find this talk extremely useful. So here we go with the Fluid Mechanics 101 podcast. I'm here on the Fluid Mechanics 101 podcast today with Dr. Chris Vogel. Chris Vogel has been a great friend and colleague of mine over the past few years, and we've shared a few research activities together. And Chris has been doing some really interesting work, and really that's what I think we're going to talk about today. We're going to first go in for a little bit of background, introduce you to Chris, what he's done and what he's doing at the moment, and then we're going to dive in and look a bit at his research in a bit more detail and hopefully come up with some really interesting nuggets of information for you listeners who are following along. So Chris, I suppose let's start things off. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I've always been interested in energy, I did my undergraduate degree in engineering in Auckland, New Zealand, and then thought, well, actually, research is quite appealing. And there was an opportunity to come to Oxford and work on tidal energy, which I'd sort of heard of a little bit, because New Zealand is situated between the Tasman Sea and the Pacific Ocean, and we get some pretty strong tides in certain parts of the country. And so it sounded like a really attractive renewable energy resource. When there was an opening in the group here in Oxford, I thought, well, might as well go and see what that's all about.
Oh, fantastic.
And luckily, they decided to let me join. And so I started working on tidal stream energy, which is basically looks somewhat like, or potentially somewhat like, putting a wind turbine underwater. And as the tides move in and out, you generate electricity. And there's a real advantage in that, in the sense that it's predictable in a way that wind energy or solar or other intermittent renewable energy sources are not. And so if you have a very highly renewable grid, then potentially this is quite a advantageous element to have in the wider energy mix. And so my work was looking at what happens when you start putting these turbines close together, and we developed some interesting results, going from some very theoretical work to thinking a little bit more about how you might actually design turbines to exploit the performance uplift that you can get when you put turbines close together underwater. And then I just stayed on in the group. And that's, I guess, when I met you. And I've continued working in tidal stream energy, but also working increasingly in wind energy as well, which is obviously out of the water now. But in the UK, one of the big things is that a lot of these turbines are moving offshore. And there are a lot of good reasons for why you might try and develop wind farms offshore, that maybe we'll get into later. But a lot of the technical analysis that we do is actually quite similar between the tidal environment and the wind environment. And so there's a nice crossover there in terms of the research strengths and some of the techniques that we can use, even though the questions themselves that we want to understand and try and develop to progress the technologies are quite different, because as I'm sure everyone knows, offshore wind is really being done on an industrial scale now. I mean, we're talking about a gigawatt a year being installed in the UK. Tidal stream is a much more embryonic technology. And so while it is starting to be commercialized, it's at a really different scale. And that sort of puts your research questions at quite a different scale of the problem.
Yeah, maybe that's something we could just speak a little bit about before going into some more detail, because I imagine many people, myself included, when they hear tidal energy or tidal stream energy, they probably haven't heard of it before, and they're not really sure what is it. You know, is it significant at all in any way, or is this just some kind of research project that a professor has come up with in a university somewhere, or is it viable anyway? And I know you mentioned that there was some tidal energy going on in New Zealand, and there's some in the UK. Perhaps could you help explain to me a little bit, sort of how significant is this tidal energy? Is it quite prevalent, yeah, or what's going on there?
It's a good question. The tidal energy has the potential to commercial in a few countries. It's not nearly as widespread as wind. I think you have to acknowledge that it's got a sort of more limited sort of application worldwide. That being said, the countries where it is possible, it does have the potential to offer some really important benefits to a wider sort of renewable electricity network, because, as I mentioned, the tides are predictable. So when we're talking about tidal energy, there's two main ways you could describe it. The first technology is called tidal range or tidal barrage. And this involves basically putting a dam across an estuary or in a bay or something like that, and you trap the water, you let the water go through the barrage, you trap it at high tide, you hold it behind the dam for a little while, and then once you've got enough of a head difference inside and outside of the barrage being built up, you let the water run out through turbines that look somewhat similar to hydroelectric turbines, in the sense that you've got this turbine in a pipe and you generate electricity that way. And there have been a few sort of perturbations around that sort of technology that have been proposed. And there are a few dams active around the world. So one of the most famous ones would be Lérance in France, which has been in operation since the 1960s. So it's quite tried and tested technology. Most recently, from what I understand, Lake Siwa in South Korea is the most recent sort of large-scale tidal barrage facility to operate. So that's a technology that's pretty well understood. But there are some challenges with it, in particular, that you've got to build a big dam before you can start generating any power. And you're blocking off a certain area from the natural sort of tidal variation in the sea. And so there are some significant environmental considerations when going down that route. So that's one technology. You're going to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to perhaps embellish on that a little bit. So it sounds like a lot of the technology is perhaps already existing. We've got some aspects of the technology which we already know how they work. And so maybe if we live or we exist in a region where there's a fairly reliable tidal current, then potentially we could think, well, we can use some existing technology to get a fairly reliable source of electricity. And I'm sure that most people intuitively understand that when the wind doesn't blow, the wind turbines don't generate any power. But the tides seem to be fairly predictable. I mean, the tides are very regular. So perhaps if we live somewhere where there's a very regular, strong tidal pattern, then we could use some existing technology to put some turbines and extract some reliable electricity. Because really, from what I've heard a lot, is that one of the main challenges with the renewables balance seems to be getting a reliable source of power when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. So it sounds like tidal perhaps forms a part of making a more reliable renewable energy source, but there are some challenges there. I think you've spoken a bit about the dams, and maybe you want to talk a bit more about some of the other challenges and where we're going.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that it's all what we're doing in energy is trying to create a reliable network. And so anything we can do on that is good. One of the interesting factors in offshore energy sources is wind and wave energy. So that's surface waves on the water are quite correlated because the wind is what generates the waves. And so the correlation in energy output is about 50%. The correlation with the tides is sort of below 1%, at least in the UK, because the tides are generated by the moon. And well, if the moon suddenly disappears, I think we may have other problems than global warming to worry about. But seeing as we're not expecting that anytime soon, tidal energy has this potentially useful contribution to make to an energy network. But it's quite challenging. So if we think about tidal stream turbines, the ones that look a bit like traditional wind turbines, but underwater, it's a very harsh environment to be operating in. And that's made up of several things. The fact you're underwater is quite difficult. You have to go to regions where the water moves quite quickly due to the tide. So you can imagine the tides bringing in and taking out a huge volume of water every 6 to 12 hours, depending on the sort of specifics of a location. And that water typically needs to be able to move it on the order of 2 to 3 meters per second to be worthwhile looking at. The peak speeds that you get, the Pentland Firth is a good example in the UK, speeds can reach up to 5 meters per second there. That's actually really quite fast. And so it's very difficult to install turbines in these locations. You've got to wait for the speeds to be low enough. You don't want too many waves while you're operating big cranes out in the water. And so the number of opportunities each month that you have to install or do maintenance on these turbines can be somewhat limited. And it also brings in interesting questions of, well, how do we design our turbines and deploy them in a way that might help ameliorate some of those problems? And so there are two big directions in tidal stream energy at the moment. One is with fixed seabed fixed foundations. So you essentially put your turbine on a pole and that pole sticks into the seabed. And that does follow a lot of the stuff that's been going on in offshore wind, where fixed foundations have traditionally been what people have been doing out at sea. The other approach you could take, though, is to have a floating turbine. And you essentially have some sort of barge or floating platform that you put your turbines on, and then you anchor that in the location where you want to extract the electricity. And because the turbines are closer to the sea surface, they're easier to access and do maintenance on, but they're also closer to where the waves are. And that wave action produces considerable unsteady loads, which can have important impacts on the sort of fatigue life of the turbine, and also introduce some interesting problems when we think about the sort of hydrodynamic control of the turbines. And
the interesting stuff.
can you operate them at fixed speeds or variable speed?
Yes.
Pitch changes, etc. And, you know, how does that sort of impact ultimately on the energy capture of the device? Because that's what we want in the end.
So conceptually, what we're doing here is if we've got sort of an area where we've got a fast tidal current, we're saying rather than block it off with a big dam and then put some turbines in the dam, what we're saying is maybe we could do similar to what we would with some wind turbines, and we stick the wind turbine in the seabed and have it above the water surface. But perhaps instead we're going to have a turbine, but rather than being above the water surface, it's going to be under the water surface, extracting energy from the stream. But it sounds like from what you've said, and I think when you get into it a bit more, you start to realize that it's a bit harder. So it's kind of like installing a wind turbine, but on hard mode, because you're installing it under the water.
That's right.
You've got a lot of additional challenges, and particularly if it's difficult to see it as well. I know just if you're a passerby, you can often see large farms of wind turbines off the shore in many areas. But the tidal turbines, although that maybe they look similar or maybe they are similar, but they're underwater, so you can't see them. Which is
that's right. They're underwater, and they're several tens of meters underwater. Potentially, and so you're not going to be able to see them. It does make it quite difficult to do monitoring of, you know, is your turbine still there?
So perhaps for my benefit and for anyone else listening, is if the turbines are underwater, are there lots of them out there already that we just don't know about? Have we not been told that there are lots of turbines underwater, or is it fairly new? Are they just got a few and they're trying it out at the moment?
It's more at the sort of developmental stage. I mean, there have been turbines, sort of prototypes deployed for quite a while. So in Stranford Lock in Northern Ireland, there was a turbine. It was actually a twin turbine arrangement. So you had a sort of tower in the middle and then a turbine on either side. That was installed in the 2000s. It was decommissioned a few years ago now, actually. So it's done its full sort of testing cycle. There are a number of testing sites around the world. So one up in Scotland called the European Marine Energy Centre. They've got some in Canada, because Canada also has some quite impressive tidal resource. A few others dotted around Europe, where people have been testing these things. And then the MayGen site is actually a commercial site. So this is in the Pentland Firth, and at the moment there are four turbines. There are plans for many, many more. The farm, when completed, would be expected to produce, I believe, about 400 megawatts of electricity. So reasonably powerful. So there are some turbines there already, operating on a commercial basis rather than just the sort of prototype testing basis.
And that's feeding electricity into the grid already. We're already getting some electricity from some tidal turbines. Just a shame that we can't see them. We'll have to.
That's right. Yes.
Have to look them up on Google to make sure they.
You can see them at the dock, but actually in the water, it's a bit more difficult.
Yeah. So maybe do we want to talk a bit more about some of the challenges? Because maybe we can. At this stage, we've probably got a good idea of what conceptually needs to happen, why we might want to put some turbines under the water, why that might be a good idea. But even just thinking about it, putting things underwater seems quite difficult. Maybe do we want to talk about some of the difficulties and talk about some of the difficulties that you've been looking at yourself, maybe?
Yeah, so perhaps the first thing to think about is whilst these tidal turbines look a lot like wind turbines, actually we know that the water is much more dense than air, so roughly 800 times denser. You do have to realize that the flow speeds are lower. So as I mentioned earlier, for a tidal turbine, you might be thinking about something on the order of 3 meters per second. Whereas for a wind turbine, rated power usually is somewhere around 10 to 12 meters per second, and they operate up to about 25 meters per second wind speed. So wind turbines operate in a much faster environment, and because the forces on the turbine go with the flow speed squared, what that actually means is that for a tidal turbine, the loading on the blades per sort of square meter is say between about 50 and 100 times that for a wind turbine. So it's not the full 100 times that is the difference in density. So that's the first problem. You've got to design turbines which are capable of withstanding much higher loads. And there are a few aspects to that. Typically, you'll have less slender blades than you would for a traditional wind turbine. And also, I mentioned briefly at the start that if you put turbines close together, you can actually get some constructive interference effects, which boost the power that you can get out. And if you want to capture that power that's theoretically available, you have to redesign the blades of the turbine to apply even more thrust to the flow. So the fundamental of this is that all of these turbines are very highly loaded, much higher loads than you would for a expect for a wind turbine. And then on top of that, we have a very unsteady flow environment. So there are impacts due to waves if you're near the wave surface. The marine environment, at least in the locations where site surveys have been done around the UK, have turbulence intensity levels of 10 to 20%. Now, for reference, offshore wind, where we're talking single figure digits of in the turbulence intensity at hub height, much, much lower than the tidal environment. And so we've got to design not only blades that take much higher load, but also they're subjected to some really quite significant fatigue loads, which is a real problem.
So it sounds like if you were an engineer approaching the tidal turbine problem, you may think that, well, a tidal turbine could look very similar to a wind turbine, but the loads are going to be considerably higher. And so that's something that you'd need, you'd probably need an analysis tool to look at, because perhaps you could do your hand calculations first and say, well, I expect the density is perhaps 800 times larger and the flow speeds are different. But really, if I'm going to design one of these and put them underwater, I need to make sure it's not going to break. And so I'm definitely going to need to do some use some analysis tools to look at the steady state loading. And then also, it sounds like you've got some quite large unsteady and fatigue loads as well coming in there. So I expect the next stage that an engineer might do when looking at that is thinking, well, we've got some tools perhaps for looking at wind turbines already, and we know they work because wind turbines don't fall down that often. Is there any way we could use those tools perhaps to look at the tidal turbines? And I don't know, what might we do when we're looking at tidal turbines? Are there any specific things that engineers might find interesting if they want to really get into the details of it?
Right. So there are a number of wind turbine design tools out there. And so whether that's bladed, which is fairly common across the industry, or you could imagine something like OpenFast as an open source version. These have been applied to looking at the tidal turbine problem as well. And there are a few tweaks that you make in terms of changes to the density and viscosity. You certainly would have to consider the different sort of sources of unsteady loads. So in particular, the wave loading would be a new factor to consider. And modules have been developed to try and implement some of these in these sorts of tools. But a lot of the learning from wind energy has also just been sort of applied straight to tidal energy. So when we think about things like the tip losses that come off these blades, people are using models that were developed a long time ago, maybe developed for wind turbines, which are very, very slender blades compared to the typically much thicker blades and, you know, much larger cord at the blade tip. And so there are quite a few instances where actually the models and the correction factors and so on that have been devised for wind turbine applications, they've been applied to tidal turbines. And certainly that probably gives you a good first guess. But the fact is that we're just a bit uncertain about how, I guess, valid these assumptions that were made for wind turbines are when applied to their tidal turbine case. So one of the other big ones that I'd mention is the proximity to the seabed and sea surface. Not even worrying about waves, actually, I mean, we know when we do wind tunnel experiments, etc., that we have to correct for the blockage of the wind tunnel. So that's the sort of frontal area of the wind turbine as it sweeps out a revolution relative to the cross-sectional area of the wind tunnel. That is usually, you know, a moderately significant ratio, by which I mean, you know, a few percent. And you try and correct for that to remove that effect, because you start going from an open flow into something that looks a little bit more like a pipe flow, and the air is forced to go through the turbine even if it doesn't want to. Now, in the tidal environment, that can also be quite significant, because you're operating very close to the boundary, at least sort of in the vertical direction, where the turbine is situated. And you can imagine, as the blades pass each revolution, you might get some sort of fluctuation on the loading, because the flow is sort of accelerated close to a boundary.
Yeah.
So there are factors like that which can contribute to, I guess, low fluctuations. They're steady in the sense that they occur every revolution. They're not stochastic, shall we say, but they are deterministic and need to be accounted
for. Yeah, need to be accounted for in the analysis tools and things. Yeah, I've always found it quite interesting to think about this. If we compare perhaps the design of a wind turbine to something more like a gas turbine engine, or when you go up the stairs to get on your flight to fly abroad, for example, and you have a quick look inside the front of a gas turbine engine, you can see that in principle we still have a rotor there. We've got a rotor rotating around. Of course, we have quite a few more fan blades for a gas turbine engine than for a wind turbine, but the shape of the blades are very different. And of course, the gas turbine blades have only got a very, very small tip clearance, whereas a wind turbine is operating in a very open space. And it sounds like the tidal turbines present a sort of an intermediate problem somewhere in between those two extremes, which is unique in its own right, because it has the space to the side of the turbine, but it's got a free surface on top. And maybe for any listeners, if they're feeling lost along the way, I find it very useful and interesting to perhaps just a quick Google search of what some tidal turbine rotors look like. And you'll see straight away with a Google search that even the designs that have been proposed so far, they look similar in a way to wind turbines, but you can see straight away at a glance that they're definitely very different. So there's a lot of clever thinking which has gone on behind the scenes, I think, and sounds like it's still needed to address the rotor problems, at least.
A quick Google is definitely a good idea. I mean, you can see how various companies have developed their ideas over time. When tidal stream was a much more nascent industry, there were some really quite unusual designs out there, at least if you're coming from a sort of wind turbines have three blades perspective. And the industry certainly has converged a little bit over time. But as you say, these are quite different. And I do quite like the comparison between the sort of gas turbine and the wind turbine, and putting the tidal turbine somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah.
In terms of, what the blades might end up looking like.
Yeah. It's also quite a hopeful message, perhaps, for anyone who's listening, maybe if with an engineering background, and you thought, I'd like to get involved with addressing the renewable energy issues that are going on these days, and I'd like to find a way to help or get involved, perhaps through my engineering or fluid mechanics knowledge. And you could look at the industry for the wind turbine industry, for example, and think, well, the rotors and the turbines look very similar and nothing really appears to be changing very much over time. But it sounds like from the discussion that the tidal sector, as part of that renewable energy mix, there's lots of interesting and exciting work going on, and there's definitely plenty to get involved with, as you and I have both done. Is it maybe worth now talking maybe in a little bit more detail about maybe an aspect or something which you looked at fairly recently that you found maybe that was very interesting, maybe go into a bit more detail?
Yeah. So I guess as we've been sort of talking about already, the loads on the turbine blades can be quite significant. And one of the things that you might expect is that, well, these blade structures are not rigid. And so when they are loaded, and you get particularly to the higher loads that you get when you're generating the maximum power, the blades start bending backwards. And that introduces some quite interesting fluid dynamic challenges, because there's a coupled relationship between the hydrodynamic loads that you develop and the response of the structure, which then feeds back into the bent shape that you get, and that results in different hydrodynamic loads, etc. So you can see how we've got a circular problem here, and it's very difficult to solve. And actually, it feeds also quite nicely back into, well, what are the limitations of some of the design tools that you might use for the first pass of the design? So one of the students that is working in the group has been looking at, well, what happens when you have these blade deformations? And principally, there are two directions that are particularly important. The flapwise direction is where the blade bends backwards. And you might expect that, because that's the direction that the flow is essentially pushing the blade. And then also we get a twist deformation, which is where the blade appears to rotate around or bend, maybe is a better description, around the sort of main axis of the blade. And it changes the angle of attack along the blade. With respect to the incoming flow, and so gives rise to different forces on the blade. And then you also get flows developing in the spanwise direction, so going up the blade. Now, these are always there, particularly near the tip of the blade, even if we just assume that the blade is perfectly rigid. But as the blade starts to bend backwards, you start getting a pressure gradient driving more of these flows along the blade. And so you really do start to diverge from the two-dimensional sort of flow principles that we use to analyze turbines with the sort of simple design tools. And you see in the CFD analysis that you're getting some really quite complicated and interrelated processes going on in terms of the blade deflections. And these all feed into variable loads that you get on the blades, and so they'll have an impact on the structure as well. And so this coupled process is quite difficult to investigate, and really you have to be going for blade resolved simulation of these phenomena, because the whole suite of tools that we've got that are slightly simpler, slightly faster to run, rely on the sort of idea of two-dimensional flow and corrections for that in appropriate regions of the blade. So they're quite difficult simulations to perform.
They sound very very complex and challenging. Definitely, just for thinking about the aerodynamics quite simply, as soon as you start saying angle of attack changes, because the aerofoil section itself is changing, immediately the aerodynamicist will start thinking about the changes to the lift, the drag, and maybe are we going to get any separation? And that's something which you could probably account for quite easily. But it sounds like for these tidal turbine blades, the effects are quite complex, three-dimensional. They're happening along the entire length of the blade, and the blade is bending and twisting dynamically. So you have to do the detailed CFD is going to be a bit more difficult.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is also a problem for wind turbines.
Yes.
And the blades, the aspect ratio of the blades is quite a lot more slender. And so the sort of development of these effects is maybe constrained more to the outboard regions of the turbine. Whereas, as we've said for tidal, the blades are a bit shorter. And so concentrate these effects, and they do affect much more of the blade. But this is one of the interesting comparisons that you can make between the two fields, that actually these problems occur for both. They might be more apparent for one or the other technology, but there is starting to be more and more of this feedback between work done in wind feeding into tidal and vice versa.
So it's a lovely example of the incremental improvements in science that we make. We make improvements in one field, and then we can use those and incrementally improve and extrapolate slightly in a slightly different field, which is really fantastic. It's really good. I'm wondering, could I ask you a little bit more in detail about the simulations you might do? Maybe the CFD, maybe fully, I'm not sure, maybe fully viscous, maybe you're doing a fluid structure interaction style approach. What sort of approach have you taken for this? Because from conventional CFD, it sounds like you've got a blade that's rotating, but it's bending, so you've got a moving boundary. So maybe that means you need to move the mesh, or I'm interested, how have you been approaching this?
So there's a few different approaches that have been done generally for this sort of thing. It's really a question of the coupling between the fluid dynamics and the structural dynamics. In some approaches, do essentially just a one-directional coupling. And so you do a simulation, you calculate the forces on the blade, use some sort of structural model, and that's it. We haven't done a fully coupled sort of problem in the sense of moving the boundary at the same time, because the mesh as the blade deforms at the same time, because really what you need there is two things. You need a structural design for your blade, so that the full sort of composites layout, and a very detailed model for what the structural performance is. And we are fluid dynamicists, not structural dynamicists, so the best we can do is a sort of reasonably simple approach to that. And the other thing is, if you consider using some sort of deforming mesh to allow the blade to move in the simulation, you have to be very careful about what that's doing near the boundary layer of the blade, because that's where most of the action is going on, as it were, in terms of what's different between just a traditional sort of rigid blade simulation versus one with a deformed blade. And so what we've done is sort of taken that coupling process offline and said, what are the forces that you get on a rigid blade? Put that into a simple sort of beam structural model of the blade to get a deformed shape. Done the CFD on that deformed shape. And then, you do a comparison to what was the change in the loads between the rigid and the deformed case. And the reasons for that are because you avoid having to have moving meshes. And I mean, those are just so incredibly computationally expensive. But also it does mean that you can really focus on getting the level of resolution that you want in near the blade, so that you know what's going on in that boundary layer region, because it's the near blade flows that drive all these processes. And so if we don't get them right, then we probably shouldn't bother doing simulation.
I think that's a really good point to make, that actually you've got two factors there to think about. You've got the first one, which is, are we actually physically going to be able to do this in our CFD code? Will the CFD code be able to handle the moving mesh with the changing quality of the cells? Are we going to accidentally compress a cell or accidentally cause the solver to diverge because we invert a cell? Do we have enough computational resource to be able to run this and resolve it all the way through? So we've got, is the computer capable of doing it? But then we've also got the second question, which is more about, do we understand the physics? Are we getting the understanding out of what the boundary layer is doing? And are we modeling the physics correctly as well? So we've actually got two important things to think about. And it sounds like the approach you've done for at the moment is really good, because it's going towards building the understanding, checking the physics, making sure you're doing it right, and actually enabling you to solve it with the computer you've got. Yeah, as well.
I think that's the you've articulated there the important scientific question, which is, you've got to think about, what is the research question here? What science do I want to get out of this? And you then have to sort of work back from that. Well, what simulations do I need to perform
that will allow
me to actually answer the scientific question? Because it's too easy to run a very pretty looking simulation that doesn't actually tell you the answers to the questions that you want to be asking it.
That's it, isn't it?
So it's tricky.
It's tricky. You almost have to you start with the research question in mind, but you also have to start with the outcome in mind as well. In a way, you kind of have to think, what exactly do I want to calculate from my model, and why do I need it? And I've been there as well. It's tantalizing to try and create an elaborate model that solves for everything, but often it's too hard, it won't work, or it's not necessary. So it sounds like your approach that you've gone for is really good. I'm excited to see the results. Are the results published at all, or are they in a paper yet, or will they be out soon?
There have been a few publications on some of the stuff, some of it in conference papers, mm-hmm. and some of it in journal papers. So we're trying to get more and more of this stuff out there.
Fantastic.
But so as you know, papers can take a while to publish.
They do. And I imagine it'll be up on your ResearchGate or something when it's ready. So and that's another thing. Obviously, I'll put a link down below to Chris's ResearchGate, so you can have a look at any of the papers that are already out, and then maybe keep tabs on what's going to come out in the future. Yeah, cool. Sounds really, really good. So that's really nice, talking about some of the research that you're doing in your group, and it sounds really interesting. It sounds like there are lots of opportunities going on at the moment as well. Perhaps the other thing I'd like to ask you a little bit about is what's your role within engineering and the group and the department, and how have you got there? Because I think quite clearly you've gone past the PhD doctoral stage, and many people will be interested. Where are you now, and sort of what are you doing?
Yeah, so after I did my doctorate, I did a few years of postdoc work within the research group. Mm. And so that was certainly, at least in engineering at Oxford, that's usually attached to a particular research project that you're working on. So a lot of that was looking at trying to exploit these interactional effects that you get when you put turbines close together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then about 3 years ago, I became a lecturer in the research group. And so that's sort of the next stage on. Not only are you sort of responsible for doing detailed work on this sort of one project, now that means I supervise some DPhil students, mm-hmm. which is Oxford's speak for PhD student. Don't ask me why we have to be different. Also, you know, thinking up project ideas is I find one of the big changes that you get between being a PhD student, where you're working on your one project.
Mm.
As a postdoc, you do very focused work, but again on a one or two projects. So as you move up the academic ladder, the number of project ideas that you're then giving to people and trying to develop with colleagues and so on really does expand. And some of that's quite exciting. So I mentioned the blade sort of hydroelastic deformation research. Actually, recently we've got got a project with a group up in Edinburgh who are experts on sort of structural dynamics and have developing a nice blade testing facility there. So we're going to try and take our fluid dynamic understanding of unsteady loading and the sort of effects that has on turbine blades, and go and do a test on a turbine blade in that facility, and see how this all compares, and can we feed that back into some of our fluid dynamic understanding.
Yeah.
And so it's quite exciting when you're able to start developing research projects like this that take things you've worked on for a while and can sort of carry them out with people around the country and around the world.
That's a really interesting discussion. It sounds like while you're going through the PhD process and the postdoc process. You're following the project and you're following through the research along a particular stream of ideas to see where it goes. And you run lots of investigations and you see how far it goes. But then when you move up into the first few rungs of the academic ladder, you almost then have to develop your own vision and your own sort of understanding for these are the strands of investigation that I think we should follow. And I think directing focus and funding towards this aspect of the problem is going to be useful and something that will attract more funding. So yeah, so it sounds a bit, it's a lot of a mentality shift. You're having that gradual mentality shift towards actually directing the important research as well as just following the research.
I think that's right. I mean, this sort of area, there are so many interesting and important research questions that no one can do them all on your own.
Yes.
And so you've got to find those people to work with, whether it's PhD students in the group or postdocs or colleagues at other institutions. I think there is that transition that you have to make that recognizes the fact that you can't do it all on your own and you've got to draw on the appropriate expertise from other people. And it's great being able to work with colleagues. And
what's the collaboration like with other universities, institutions and other groups? How does that go? It's not something I know much about. Yeah. How have you found that?
It's quite interesting. And it's one of the things that actually the pandemic has made a bit more challenging because, I mean, as you know, going to conferences is quite an interesting experience. Mm-hmm. And you get to hear about lots of work that other people are doing. And you go along to talks that you might otherwise not have thought to read a journal paper on that particular topic. And so as a PhD student, those are really useful for getting a perspective on what other research is going on in the community. And maybe meeting a few like-minded people at other institutions and so on. And I mean, it's quite nice going to these things now because having been in the sort of area for a few years, you recognise a lot of the people, and it's always nice catching up. How are things going at their places when you're at these conferences? And from that, you can start to think about, well, actually, you're an expert on XYZ, and I've just had an idea that might be quite relevant. And so you can start to sort of build these things somewhat organically. Now, it's a bit more difficult to meet people if there's no conferences. So there have been a few online ones, and we'll see how that goes. But
more difficult for the coffee breaks to go and talk
Absolutely.
To people if it's an online conference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, it's that sort of thing where I think engineering as a discipline is quite collaborative because there's, mechanical engineering, civil, electrical, and pretty much every other variant under the sun, which, and you need all of these people to try and make a wind turbine or a tidal turbine project be successful. And so it is about meeting those people in other disciplines as well as just, your friends doing the same thing as you at a different university.
Yeah. And so it sounds like when you go to the conference, that's a good sort of snapshot of the community in this case, the tidal energy, I suppose you'd say tidal energy research community.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like as an entire group or field, you're pushing the field forward together. So the engineering aspects are very collaborative in that way, because maybe you have the fluid dynamics expertise and investigations, but you need to go and talk to the structural engineers about the response of the blade to the twisting and bending.
That's right. And the other important thing is that, we are doing engineering here, so we hope that our work will have relevance to the industrial community. And conferences are quite a good forum to be meeting those people as well. So it's not just meeting the academic expert on composite layup or something like that. It's also actually meeting the industrial partners who can say, these are our key problems. And that also, you know, provides some good focus for where do you take your research next? Because we all hope that it ultimately is relevant to someone.
Yeah. Because that is often one criticism of academic communities in general, is that they don't have much interface with industry. And in this case, it would be companies who are designing, commissioning, and installing tidal turbines. But so it sounds like with the tidal energy community, maybe because it's quite early on in its development process, that you do have quite good links with industrial partners. Is the whole thing a large community? Do you have there? Is it thousands? Is it hundreds? Or is it 20, 30 people?
I think we're talking community like hundreds.
A few hundreds, yeah.
For the tidal community. I mean, I would say on the sort of incorporating academic and industrial work, the ability to do that really does depend on the specific field that you're working in. And so companies may not be necessarily able to change their blade design because they've gone through that process, but maybe the work we do can provide them with confidence on the lifetime modeling of something of their existing assets. And so I think one of the challenges in engineering is also to identify where is that contribution able to be made. There are some fields, geotechnical engineering might be an example, where understanding the specific conditions at an offshore site, whether that's for an offshore wind farm or a tidal farm, that leads into direct improvements in the design and cost of the wind farm being developed in a few years' time. And so the timeline for that sort of impact, as it were, can be quite short. When we talk about innovative blade designs or something like that, actually that sort of next generation technology type sort of situations. And so the time frame must necessarily be quite a lot longer for when the full sort of impact of improved blade designs, shall we say, get implemented. And so you might also have to think there, well, what's the more immediate impact? And can that just be reducing uncertainty in the sort of lifetime estimates or something like that?
What
these companies need right now. And that's something that I think, both sides, industry and academia, need to sort of keep in mind when trying to work together. Because the two do operate on different timescales, and so it's not just solving problems now, but also what are the problems going to be in 3 or 5 or 10 years time?
Do you think that's just a feature of tidal being a relatively new field, the timelines being different? Would you say that perhaps the timelines tend to converge a bit more as technology gets more mature?
I think actually there's a similar sort of thing can be said in wind and other fields as well. So the work that we do in wind energy largely focuses on the sort of wind farm dynamics. The design of turbines themselves is pretty well established, and the contributions we can make there are somewhat more limited. But I mean, when you talk about designing wind farms and layout of wind farms, we're talking best part of a decade. Sort of time horizon there, so that is still quite a long way out. And I mean, if we went to the really extreme case, you could talk to colleagues in sort of space sciences, people who design probes for other planets. I mean, that's a multi-decade horizon between when you start the project and when it might actually be entering the atmosphere of
a certain planet. So,
I'm sure there are cases. I imagine computer technology or intelligence type stuff. The time frame there might actually be really short. I don't know enough about it, but that's a very rapidly moving field, and so might indeed be going into next year's sort of iPhones or whatever it is.
Yeah,
and it's just a factor of how quickly can these decisions be taken.
So maybe just a few things to finish off. I'm interested in your thoughts on, we've talked a lot about tidal energy and some of the challenges, where it comes from and what we're trying to do. Have you got any thoughts on where the tidal energy industry is going in the next few years? Because we've there have been various government announcements and agreements around the world about climate change objectives and things. How do you feel tidal energy is developing, and where do you think it fits in with all this over the next, say, decade or more?
Yeah. So I think the net zero commitments made by government have been very important, because it's no longer possible to say, well, actually, we're going to offset our carbon emissions by doing something else. Every industry has to sort of, you know, solve its carbon problems. And so I think we have to put all of this in the context of developing a reliable, renewable energy network. And that has to involve lots of different technologies, because you want to be able to rely on the sort of statistical anti-correlation of different energy sources. And so when the wind isn't blowing, can we at least rely on there being more solar or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
And tidal will only ever play a small part in that process. Certainly for the UK, the forecasts are for energy production to be dominated by wind. But in the cases where things are really bad and the wind isn't blowing, a little bit of electricity is incredibly valuable. And these energy storage requirements to make up for the 1 in 10 year energy shortfall that lasts multiple weeks or something like that is incredibly expensive compared to the amount of storage that you would need for day-to-day or week-to-week type energy transfers in the grid. And so being able to have something that's a little bit niche, but really provides something that's completely uncorrelated with your dominant energy supply, such as tidal stream, does have the potential to make a really valuable contribution. And so it's not necessarily going to power everything, but it provides power when you really, really need it. And so that's certainly an avenue that I think the industry should be trying to pursue. And the other potential contribution is in island regions where they're relying on diesel generation or something similar to that at the moment. Diesel is incredibly expensive and polluting. And so actually targeting things like that, what is the energy value that you're providing rather than just the
megawatt hour figure?
Is a really important thing for the industry to be thinking about. And that will feed into bigger picture sort of planning on how many wind farms do we need? How much energy storage do we need? And all that sort of thing.
Even conceptually, you can see how for a small island nation or perhaps an isolated coastal community somewhere, you can see that they may rely on diesel generators, loan diesel generators to power things. And being near coastlines or islands, quite likely to have restricted perhaps tidal channels or causeways. And for those sort of niche applications, that the tidal can make as a large fractional difference perhaps to that community's energy supply, which otherwise it may be very isolated and sort of left abandoned. So we do often think about the big, you know, the big grid and the large cities and chunks of the mainland. But I think that's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that before. And I like the explanation with the batteries and the energy storage as well, because it is something that we do forget that there, of course, will be times where the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine and the others don't happen. And all of a sudden we're left with quite a difficult situation. And I think it pulls back to what you said earlier about the tides being largely uncorrelated with the wind and the waves, that perhaps the physics that drives it.
That's right. Yeah. I think you've got to sort of look out for those opportunities where there's something that isn't going to be affected by the same processes as other energy sources. The Germans have a great word for the no wind, really cold sort of period where you're struggling to produce energy. It's the Dunkelflaute. Yeah. Apologies to any Germans who think I've butchered that, but it's a great word, and a really interesting problem.
A really interesting problem, and that's definitely something we're trying to plan for.
Yes.
Anyway, I think that probably just about wraps up everything I thought we'd talk about today. It's been a really good conversation. I've really enjoyed having you on. Thank you very much for coming on, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And for anyone listening, of course, I'll provide information and further links and things down in the description below. So if you'd like to check out Chris's research, his research group, and what he's working on now, just have a look through the links below, and I'm sure you'll find what you're looking for there. And until next time, thank you very much for tuning into the Fluid Mechanics 101 podcast, and we'll see you next time. So that wraps up the discussion that I had with Dr. Chris Vogel on the Fluid Mechanics 101 podcast. As this is a new podcast and this is the first episode, I'm really interested in hearing from you how you thought it went. Did you enjoy the podcast? Did you find it useful? Were there any bits that you found particularly interesting? If you have any thoughts, please just drop a comment in the comments section below. I really look forward to hearing from your comments. I'm definitely going to have a read of these, and they'll be really useful for me because it can help me to frame and direct future conversations that I have with guests in future on the Fluid Mechanics 101 podcast. So please let me know, how did you think it went? Do you have any suggestions? Let me know in the comments section below. And finally, to wrap up, just want to send a final thanks to all of the listeners, for all of you out there for listening to the podcast. I really appreciate your time and attention with listening to the podcast here. So thank you all for listening, and I'll see you next time.